prayers. I'll recite it now. There's a long version and a short version. I'll just do the short version. But it's very good if we can memorize this and recite it a lot, and better yet, really integrate it with our hearts. Okay, so it starts out, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering in its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. So the first one, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes, that's love, and that's actually the definition of love, wanting sentient beings to have happiness in its causes. So you see already it's very different from the love we hear about on the radio and in the movies, which is, I want you to have happiness in its causes as long as you give me happiness in its causes. That's called attachment. Okay. And then the second one is compassion. May all sentient beings be free of suffering in its causes. So that's what compassion is, that wish to be free of suffering. And so we can see there that compassion isn't ushy-gushy, gooey, you know, oh, you poor cop, you know, thing. It's quite different from pity. Yeah, just the heartfelt wish for self and others to be free of suffering and its causes. And then may all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. That is immeasurable joy. Okay, not wanting anybody to be separated from either temporal happiness, the happiness we have in samsara, or ultimate happiness, the happiness of liberation and enlightenment. And then in the short version, the last one is equanimity. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. Okay, so that's the mind that's free of bias, attachment, and anger. In the long version of the Four Immeasurables, equanimity comes first. And it seems to me, actually, when we meditate, it's better for equanimity to come first, because it's very difficult to generate love and compassion and joy as long as our mind is very partial. So we're going to talk about equanimity first. Yeah. Now, before we go any further, do you feel that talking about love, compassion, joy, and equanimity is a little bit of a radical, revolutionary thing in America these days? You know, considering what we're fed in the media, does it feel a little bit strange to be talking about kindness and love and equanimity? So throughout the talk, I will probably make several social statements. Okay. To be a Buddhist, you do not have to. There's not one political view that all Buddhists hold, okay? And you don't have to have a certain political or military view to be a Buddhist, okay? I'm sure my own preference will come out, but this is not a political talk. What I'm trying to do is bring in some examples that relate to what we're experiencing. The reason being twofold. First of all, I feel that that our spiritual practice should be applicable to our daily life and to what's going on in our daily life. And the war in Iraq is going on in our daily life, isn't it? So I don't think religion is something that, you know, we do to escape from daily life, to ignore daily life, but we should learn something from our spiritual path that helps us live our life. So that's one reason I want to bring in these kinds of examples. A second reason is that since the war began, I've found people very hungry for some kind of spiritual guidance about how to see things. I was doing a month retreat in Idaho, until March 20th, and I was in silence, totally incommunicado. And my friend came to pick me up on March 20th, and I found out that the war started the night before. And since then, I've taught in Boise, in California, in Kansas, in Kansas, and in Missouri, and now here. So people seem to want some kind of spiritual guidance. So I'll use some examples that relate to that. Also, because, you know, it's real easy to think about love and compassion and equanimity when we think about, you know, people that we don't know, and when we think in this Pollyanna thing, oh yes, you know, everybody's equal, everybody wants happiness, may everybody be happy. We write it in our Christmas cards, you know. But is that really how we feel? And can we really feel, I mean, do we feel love for Saddam Hussein? You know, do you feel love for George Bush? Some people have more difficulty loving Saddam. Some people have more difficulty loving Bush. It doesn't really matter. But the point is that, you know, when we're generating love and compassion, it's towards individuals. It's towards real living beings. It's not towards some kind of abstract fairyland sentient beings who are this whole. And then, meanwhile, everybody around us who we don't like, we trash them. Okay? So it's not like that. So I think there's some value to pointing out examples that push our buttons, because it challenges our usual way of thinking. Okay, so let's start with equanimity, because like I said, I think that's kind of the foundation of the whole thing. Okay, so equanimity is a mind that's free of bias, okay, so prejudice. Yeah, we all like to think we don't have prejudice, don't we? Yeah, I mean, it's not politically correct to admit that we're prejudiced, okay, but we won't tell anybody outside this room, you know, do you think you're really free of prejudice? No. We all have our prejudices, don't we? And, you know, what one person is prejudiced against, another person isn't. So we all have our own kind of variety. But I think it's pretty important for our spiritual practice that we admit that we are biased and we are prejudiced. Okay? You know, even though it's not politically correct. But it's true. And, you know, we'll never get rid of it if we can't acknowledge having it. Okay, so free of bias, attachment, and anger. Yeah. Are we free of attachment and anger? No. We're not free of those either, are we? We're full of attachment and anger. That's more accurate, isn't it? Yeah. Kind of somebody nice comes along who gives me presents, who praises me, who says nice things about me. Oh boy, I like that person. I'm attached to them. I want to be around them. Yeah. Somebody comes along and does just the opposite, you know, and they talk behind my back and they ruin my reputation and they point out my faults. Even if I have faults, you should not point them out. You know, they are not to be noticed. Yeah. And so anger and hatred, spite, revenge, you know, arise very easily. So you can see we're very biased, aren't we? Anything that pleases center of the universe, me, we get attached to. Anything that displeases center of the universe, me, we get upset with. Okay? You don't have to take what I'm saying on face value. Just examine your own life and see if it's true. See if this applies to your life or not. Yeah? See, do you feel the same way about somebody who gossips about you behind your back as you do about, you know, the person you love the most? except sometimes the person you love about the most talks about you behind your back. You know, but we see we feel very different, don't we, in general? Yeah? So the mind is very, very biased. And it's all biased that the whole categorization occurs in terms of me. Yeah? So anybody that's nice to me, I mean, that's how everything gets evaluated, is through the lens of me. And the thing is, most of the time we don't recognize that. We think that when we see people, we're seeing them objectively. You know, there's that person out there, and they're fantastic from their own side, completely independent of me. And this other person is an idiot from their own side, completely independent of me. That's the way we see it, isn't it? And that's the way we talk about other people, you know? But if we look, if we analyze a little bit closer, people go into these categories of friend and enemy and stranger based completely on how they relate to me. Okay? Because everybody has some good qualities and some bad qualities, right? If you show your good qualities to me, you're my friend. If you show your bad qualities to somebody else, you're also my friend. If you show your bad qualities to me, now you're my enemy. Same bad qualities. If you show them to somebody else, I don't care much. If you show them to me, then you're my enemy. I don't like you. And if you show your bad qualities to somebody who I also don't like, then you're on my side, you know. You're smart. You hate the same people I do. Yeah? So you see, it's not a thing of, like, if people have good qualities or bad qualities. Our whole discrimination is based entirely on what face they happen to be showing towards us in any particular moment, isn't it? And people go from the friend category to the enemy category very quickly, don't they? Somebody praises you, they're in the friend category. Then they criticize you, they go into the enemy category. So we can see in our personal relationships that, you know, the people in these three categories are changing all the time, you know, based on how we discriminate them. Okay, whether we put them in the friend category, the enemy category, or the stranger category. And so this holds true on our personal relationships, because I think we can all think of somebody who, you know, we were very attached to, who later we can't stand and don't speak to. Yeah? We can think of people who at one time we couldn't stand, who later we become very good friends with. We can think of people who we didn't like, who became strangers. Are people who we cared a lot about who became strangers, and so we became apathetic towards them. So, you know, these things are changing all the time, again, based on me. So our mind is not a very reliable indicator of somebody else's value, because it's very, very subjective. And like I said, these things change. So this happens personally. It happens internationally. Okay? World War II, Germany was our enemy. Okay? Japan was our enemy. Now Japan's a very good friend. Germany, it depends how they vote on the UN, whether we like them or don't like them. France was our friend in World War II. You know, now we can't even say French fries. Yeah? These relationships are just changing all the time, completely, you know, also on the international scene. And if you look at our government policy, it's the same way. Yeah? I mean, I think, didn't we back Saddam at one point against Iran? So, yeah?
So he was our friend at one time, and now he's the enemy. We also backed the fundamentalists from Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden. They were our friends at one point. Now they're our enemies. So you see how all these relationships just keep changing all the time, you know? And it's all based on how people relate to me, my, I, and mine. Yeah? It has nothing really to do with their qualities, you know, in them. It has to do with us. So it's quite a self-centered way of evaluating things. What we're trying to do when we meditate on equanimity is free ourselves from the attachment, the anger, the bias, and the apathy. You know, why? For many reasons. First of all, when we have attachment, anger, bias, and apathy in our minds are not very peaceful. Many people have told me that since the war started, they've been having a lot of emotions come up. Is that happening for you people? I'm seeing some people nod their heads and some people... I don't know what. Yeah, but they've told me that, you know, just all sorts of strong emotions have been coming up in reaction to the war. Yeah. And so we can see, and very often, you know, the emotions are of the three things people have told me principally are feeling helpless, feeling afraid, and feeling angry. Yeah. When our mind is filled with anger and fear, is our mind happy? Is it peaceful? Is it tranquil? No. Okay? So that already is a good reason to try and do something about our anger and aversion, because we're miserable when they arise in our mind. Yeah. We might feel very right when we're angry, but feeling like we're right does not necessarily mean we're happy, because we can be right up, down, and across. It doesn't make much difference. Like when we get in a fight with a friend, you know, and everybody else agrees with our side. You ever notice that? How when you get in a fight with somebody, then you go and talk to your other friends, and of course they agree with you, because that's why they're your friends. You know, if they agreed with the person you had the fight with, you wouldn't be talking with them and calling them your friends. Okay, so, you know, they agree with us, and they tell us we're right, and we know we're right, and the other person's wrong, and the world agrees with us, but are we happy? No. Okay, so being right and being happy are not synonymous. Think about that one for a while. Because we get really stuck on being right. I don't know about you, but I do. Anybody else here get stuck on being right? Who else gets stuck? Only two people? Three? Who else gets stuck on being right? Oh, a few more. Okay. Not this side of the room. You guys didn't raise your hands at all, huh? Yeah. You know, but we can get so, you know, so much energy about being right and be totally miserable. And we can be right and create a ton of negative karma, can't we? You know, because we're so right that we have to clobber the people who are wrong. You know, because the people who are wrong are dangerous. Yeah. So, you know, we're doing it out of compassion for them. You know, they're wrong, they're making mistakes, they're creating negative karma, so we better clobber them so that they don't create any more negative karma, so they can be saved. You got it. We're going to save them. Thank you. Yeah. And we're filled with compassion doing this. Why? Because we're right. You know, and God's on our side. Yeah. Have you ever noticed that when, on a personal level or on a national level, whenever we're in a quarrel, we are the ones who are morally superior? Even on a personal level, you know, you fight with somebody in your office, they're the ones who are lying. We're the ones who are telling the truth. We're morally superior. Yeah. And you see this all throughout history, you know, wars being fought, and, you know, poor God. I mean, everybody's invoking him on their side. I mean, if you were God, wouldn't you go a little bit crazy? I mean, think about it. Osama bin Laden says you're on his side. George Bush says you're on his side. You know? I mean, if you're God, you're going to go nuts. So, you know, we do this. You know, when we're right, we are morally superior. We see ourselves filled with compassion, and we are doing it for the good of other people. Okay? So if we trash somebody in our office, we're doing it for their good. If we beat our kid to a pulp, we're doing it for their good. If we drop bombs on Iraq, we're doing it to liberate them. Even though they didn't ask us, we're going to save them. Okay? So you can see how there's a lot of partiality going on in here. Okay? And how the mind is functioning from a very, very self-centered position, and how getting stuck in being right promotes anger, which promotes unhappiness in ourselves. And then, of course, when we act with anger, yeah, do we create peace in the world? I mean, this is the question I had years before I became a Buddhist, you know. Some of you look kind of about my age. Remember the Vietnam War, you know, and remember being told that we're going to fight people so that we can live in peace. And I remember being 16 years old saying, I don't get it. Yeah. And this was years before being a Buddhist. You know, I don't get it. How come we're killing people to live in peace? I don't get it. And I still don't get it. Okay? But we can see that when we act out of anger and we kill people, you know, it doesn't necessarily bring peace. Okay? Now, well, basically because the philosophy is, and again, this works on national level and on personal level. The philosophy behind anger and violence is, I'm going to beat you up so much until you decide to like me and do it my way. Don't you think when you look at your own mind, you know, when you're upset with somebody, isn't that kind of the belief system that the mind is holding in that time? I'm going to be so nasty to you until you decide that you like me and you're going to do it my way.
Okay. Is it like when you're a baby?
That's the point. Yeah, it's obey. But we say to ourselves, you know, we think that if somebody obeys us, that they like us. Uh-uh. We think that if somebody caves into us, that we've won. Uh-uh. Because as soon as in a conflict, and here you can talk to people who, you know, who study conflict, you know, and teach it at the university, that if you have a resolution to a conflict where one party is totally squashed, it's not really a resolution because that party is going to be unhappy and they're going to start doing more things that make the victorious party unhappy. So the conflict hasn't really been resolved. Yeah. And again, I think that happens a lot because of the mind being biased. And when we see a conflict, we feel like we have to take sides. You know, if I'm for this side, then I'm against this side. You know, so I either have to advocate all the policies of this side or I have to advocate all the policies of this side. And neither of those ways of viewing a situation solve the conflict. And I think here's where the power of compassion comes in, and where the power of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's message of nonviolence comes in. In other words, when we look at a conflict, if we can have compassion for everybody involved in the conflict and want everybody involved in it to be happy, then there's a chance that the conflict might be resolved or there might be some peace coming about. But in a conflict, when we see what we term resolution, meaning one party squashed and the other party's victorious, it's not really a resolution.
Okay. But the victorious party doesn't want the other party to be upset.
Yeah, right. But how does that happen? You know, because if we look at it when it happens that we're the ones that are squashed, you know, are we happy just because somebody, you know, squashed us and then they say, well, it's all over, so, you know. It doesn't work, okay? So, you know, like I said, it happens on international politics, it happens on personal levels. And I think that's very much what they say, you win the battle but you lose the war, because I think losing the war means that you continue to have war, yeah? Because if we're really looking for resolution, we have to take the feelings of everybody in the situation and value them. And I think that's the meaning of equanimity, seeing that the feelings of everybody in a situation are valuable, you know, and that everybody in the situation is deserving of respect. And it's not an issue of criticizing and putting somebody down. It's an issue of seeing what are these people's needs and concerns and what are these people's needs and concerns and how can we come up with something that's going to help everybody in the situation. Yeah. Okay, so equanimity pulls us out of that self-centered view that makes us get stuck in right and wrong, this party or that party, you know, victor and loser. But equanimity helps us value everybody and care about everybody equally. Now the question comes up, how in the world are we supposed to care about everybody equally? Okay? And so here, you know, if we use the present conflict, you know, some people may say, how am I supposed to care about Saddam Hussein and those Iraqis who are making weapons of mass destruction? You know, how can I care about those people the same way that I care about people in my own country who are so peaceful and loving? Even though, have you noticed, excuse me, I can't help myself, but you just tolerate me. You can throw tomatoes if you don't like my views. But have you ever noticed that the only threat of anthrax this country has ever had was traced to a U.S. anthrax lab? I just find that interesting. But that's beside the point. So some people might say, how in the world can I, you know, I have equanimity for people who are making weapons of mass destruction, meaning the Iraqis. And then you have other people in the country saying, how can I have equanimity towards people who are making weapons of mass destruction, meaning George Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld? Yeah? It's very interesting, isn't it? Yeah? How the kind of the issue is the same that everybody's getting worked up. They just project it on two different parties. It's very interesting. Okay, but what happens is that then our mind gets polarized, and then our whole country gets polarized, and then the whole world gets polarized. Okay, and it just brings about more and more conflict. So the question comes, well, how are we supposed to have equanimity for these people who are doing all these awful things? You know, and of course, lying behind this is the notion that I'm pure. Did you notice the change? That I'm pure. That I'm pure and innocent and sweet and don't do anything wrong. Yeah, but let me go off on a short little diversion here. Have you ever noticed that on a personal level we have our own weapons of mass destruction? Think about it. You know, you don't put anthrax and, you know, by chemical weapons out. But aren't our words, think about what you say to other people. Think about your speech. Is your speech sometimes a weapon of mass destruction? Think about it for a minute. You know, sometimes speech, the bombs that we drop with our speech, are much more painful to others, aren't they? Things we say, especially to the people we care about the most. Have you ever noticed, you know, who do we drop our speech bombs on? Who do we let out our anthrax speech and our chemical agent speech on? The people we care about the most, isn't it? Family members, dear friends. We never treat strangers the same way we treat somebody we care about. Okay. So I'm also getting at, in this whole thing, you know, that it's not a thing of like trashing Saddam, trashing Bush, and here I am. I'm so sweet and innocent, I don't do anything wrong. You know? I mean, I may not have bombs and everything like that. I mean, when you're a nun, you're poor, you kind of can't do that. But... you know, I didn't leave my tank parked out. But our speech can be like a tank, can't it? The way we talk to people, we roll right over them. And our speech can be a machine gun. You know, at a board meeting, you know, in the Dharma Center, or a board meeting at work, we just shoot everybody. You know? Or we drop our bombs. You know, I want a divorce tomorrow. Goodbye. Give me all the money. Yeah. So we're not totally innocent parties in all of this, okay? But still, getting back to the original question, how do we have equanimity? Yeah. When we see people doing nasty, horrible things, no matter which side we happen to blame, how do we have equanimity for them? I think one way is to, like we were saying before, to see that the relationships change all the time, that nobody is forever in a friend or an enemy camp, to see, second of all, that the relationships are determined by our own biased mind, because we put people in the friend or the enemy category. Okay? A third way is to realize that everybody wants happiness and everybody wants to be free of suffering. Okay? So whether you have more trouble with Bush or with Saddam, whoever it is, think that person wants to be happy and they want to be free of suffering. Now, have you ever thought about that? Or the person at work that you can't stand, have you ever thought that they want to be happy and be free of suffering? Or the person who cut you off on the highway? That's the big American insult, isn't it? They cut me off on the highway. You know? Do we ever think that person wants to be happy and not suffer? Or the dog that bites you? Okay? No. So this is a very good practice, I think, for us as we go places and look at people to constantly say to ourselves, you know, this person wants to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Constantly remind ourselves. You know, when you're watching TV and, you know, because the images we get can stir up so much. So depending, and like I was saying, you know, different people are getting stirred up by different things. Yeah. But just to say, think as you look at each person, you know, that person wants to be happy and not suffer. Yeah. So when you're watching these pictures of the Iraqis looting, you know, they want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Yeah. Or, you know, the suicide bombers, they want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Or the American troops who you know. Sometimes harm innocent people who are unarmed. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Okay. And all the different political figures in this whole thing, you know, just remember, they all want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. And that's what's motivating everybody's behavior. Okay. So it's not that people are inherently evil and that they're trying to harm others. No. When people do harmful things, it's because they're miserable. And they're trying to find a way to be happy. Yeah. I don't think the real reason people do harmful things is because they're nasty and awful and want to inflict harm. Because even if the thought comes, you know, I want to inflict harm on somebody, that comes from a mind that's suffering, doesn't it? I mean, nobody... When people are happy, they don't have the mind that wants to harm others. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I feel so happy, I feel loved, and the sun is shining, and I feel full of self-confidence, I feel so good, I think I'm going to go kill somebody. Mm-hmm. Nobody says that. Nobody thinks that. I mean, people only harm others when they're unhappy, and they're trying to be happy, and they don't know a method to be happy that's actually going to bring about happiness. Okay? And so this applies to others, but it also applies to ourselves. I mean, and so I'm trying to really equalize here. You know, we're not separate from everybody else. Can you look in your own life and see mistakes that you've made that you did not because you were harmful, but because you were trying to be happy and you didn't know how to be happy? Can you think of at least one thing? Maybe 100? You know, times when we've done things that have been harmful or painful to others, but the real reason was because we were miserable, not because we're evil people or not because we really wanted to make somebody else suffer, but because we were confused and we were unhappy, and so we just did whatever came into our mind. Well, that's the same thing that other people are doing when they do harmful things to us. It's the same mental mechanism. So if we can have some forgiveness for ourselves and some compassion for ourselves, then, you know, and the mistakes that we've made due to our unhappiness and our confusion, then let's extend that same kind of forgiveness to other people. Yeah? Because they're just like us, you know? Not that much different. Okay? So I think, you know, that's a very good way to generate some kind of equanimity, you know? To remember also that everybody equally has the Buddha potential. It's not that Americans have more Buddha potential than other people on this planet. Okay? Being a superpower does not give you more Buddha potential than everybody else. Okay? So, you know, because that, when we can see that everybody has the potential to be fully enlightened, then we can respect that part of a person, okay? And then no matter what they do, no matter how they act, we can respect them. We can, you know, yeah, respect, I think, is a very, very good word. We can honor them and see them as somebody who's worthwhile. And I say this because I do prison work, and every year I come here, it's also because I go do a prison visit in Marion, and so I'm going tomorrow to do another prison visit. And I've been doing a lot of prison visits and a lot of correspondence. And this is one of the big things that comes through to me in doing prison work is the value of respecting others, and that everybody is deserving of respect, no matter what they've done in their lives. You know? And I think it's a great tragedy when we just label somebody criminal or evil, put a label on them and toss them out. Last week it was, I was at Potosi, which is the maximum security prison in Missouri, where they do the executions. Missouri is the third highest state in our country after the two Bush states that does execution, you know. Texas has executed 301 people since the death penalty has been accepted again. And after that comes Florida, then comes Missouri. So Potosi is where they do the executions. So there's two Catholic nuns who do a meditation group there. These two Catholic nuns also do Buddhist meditation, but they're Catholic and they do a meditation group. And the meditation group is great. It has Christians and Buddhists and Muslims, and everybody comes and does this meditation group. It's really neat. So I've been down there a few times. They've invited me to come and like lead a retreat or, you know, be a guest speaker to the group. And so I went last Thursday. It was my third visit at Potosi. And I'm sitting in this room. I don't know what all the guys in there for are in there for. The ones that I know are all in there for murder. I assume the other ones are too, because it's a maximum security prison. And some of the murders that these people are in for are pretty gruesome murders. But, and this is probably going to sound really strange to you, I mean, last Thursday I felt very honored to be with these people. It was one of the nicest times I've had with a group of people in a long time. And that they were very, very caring people. Yeah. And it's hard for us to say, oh, somebody who's murdered somebody can be a caring person. It's true, they can be. Yeah. And I know many people like that. In February, I was at Oregon State Penitentiary, and I went to speak to two guys on death row who were in for really ugly murders. Yeah. And they were very, very nice people. And one of them especially, just his telling me like about his childhood and his upbringing and how he's changed and how he views the whole thing now. Incredible the change this person has gone through. Yeah. And when you hear the stories of some of these people and how the lives they experienced as children, you're not surprised at how they wound up being in prison. And what that does for me is it makes me look around and think, how many other children are we cultivating to be criminals right now through not taking care of them as kids? Yeah. Okay. I think this relates to Buddhist practice. Yeah. I mean, this is about love and compassion and connection. Okay. And Buddhism isn't just about, you know, oh, let's feel good about everybody and we're all going to get enlightened. It's, you know, our enlightenment depends on having love and compassion for each and every individual. If we exclude one person from our love and compassion, it's impossible for us to get enlightened. You know? And those of you who've taken, you know, aspiring and engaging bodhicitta, you've heard the lama say this a lot. And it's true, you know, we eliminate one person from our love and compassion, and we are preventing our own spiritual progress. So we are dependent upon these other beings. And so it's essential that we find a way to open our heart to them. Yeah? And a way to have genuine respect for people who have done things that make us feel threatened, make us feel afraid. You know, people have done things that we think are despicable. We have to find a way to value these people, you know. And it's too simplistic just to put a label on them and throw them in the garbage bin. And I don't care if it's, you know, one criminal who we've locked away for life, who you never meet, or if it's an international, you know, somebody who's going to go on trial for war crimes, you know. If our heart closes towards one being, we are closing ourselves spiritually. Kind of scary when you think that, isn't it? Yeah? But it's true. And I think it's important for us to look inside and say, why do I close my heart to some people? What is it in me that's making me close my heart? And this needs a lot of reflection on our part, you know. What is it inside of us that makes us close our heart? And I think sometimes, very often, it's fear. Yeah, we feel vulnerable, we feel afraid. So when, you know, it's very unpleasant to feel afraid and to feel vulnerable or to feel powerless. When we get angry, when we close our heart to somebody else, then we feel like we have some power. Okay. But anger is kind of, it's not a healthy way to feel like we have power. Yeah. Because anger doesn't make us happy. So I think this is a good question for us to keep it. You know how the Zen people have koans? You know, I think our koan as we live our daily life, you know, when we notice it, what is it that's making me close my heart? You know, or another koan, put it in a positive way, how can I open my heart? What is it that I need to train my mind to see in others or train my mind to see in myself that will enable me to respect and have an open heart towards somebody else? And it also goes for the dog next door. Okay? Yeah. Or the mosquito who's biting you. Or the butterfly who's so beautiful, and or the hummingbirds that come and eat by your breakfast table. Okay? And it also goes towards the people that we like so much, you know. How can I generate, you know, respect and see potential and see kindness and see beauty in each and every other living being? And how can I let go of that part of me that closes my heart because I'm afraid? Good question. I wish I knew the answer. Okay, but this is what practice is about. This is what our practice is about. Okay, so when we're doing all these visualizations and we're chanting all these mantras and doing prostrations, it's all to get to this point. Okay, I mean, why do we do prostrations? To purify the times that we've closed our heart. Okay? Why do we make offerings to the Buddha? To open our heart, to train our mind in taking joy and generosity. Why do we chant mantra? To calm the mind and stop that mental chatter that's going, I don't like what this person is doing, and that person is doing this, why doesn't this one do it this way? The whole world's all best. Why don't they just run the world the way I want them to? Okay, we chant mantra to silence that mind. It needs to be silenced, doesn't it? Okay, so, you know, don't start thinking that Buddhist practice is just some airy-fairy. I mean, you're students of Gelug Rinpoche. You're not going to think it's airy-fairy. That matters, are you? Rinpoche is not going to let you get into some Tibetan trip. Is he? Okay.